Good morning, and I thank the organizers for rearranging the schedule so that I can catch my plane. I apologize for disrupting the intellectually coherent morning program by wedging in a talk on dislocations and this talk with a large number of co-authors who actually did a gigantic amount of work of assembling it is a kind of a review article. Trying to make the case that this age-old problem that people hammering on bronze swords in the ancient days had to grapple with is a good example of the kinds of memory questions that we address in statistical physics, trying to draw links, trying to understand what could be comprehensible, what should be comprehensible. The outline of the talk, I'm going to start off by telling you things that I've always found fascinating about crystals. Their subtle broken symmetry. They're in many ways as interesting or more interesting than more exotic broken symmetries like superfluidity and a much more practical importance. If we didn't have solids, we really would be screwed. I'll tell you a little bit about historical kinds of memory effects that you would naturally assume would prevent you from coming up with a simple theory. I'll talk a little bit about equilibrium thermodynamics, which is our main tool for understanding things, where we erase the past and allow us to, and then a bunch of recent theories in physics that try to look for non-equilibrium analogs for equilibrium statistical mechanics. I'll then make the case both that dislocations in crystals show aspects of criticality, which is becoming a much very mainstream topic, even in the engineering community, and that criticality may replace equilibrium as a way of yielding comprehensible behavior. And then at the end, I'll make a brief case for the fact that engineering materials come in a bewildering variety of types, and we have to look to see, insofar as our tools of universality and scale invariance are going to be applicable, they're going to have to become much modified, that there's got to be room for a much more diverse set of phenomena than we're used to. Starting off with crystals, remember their shape. So when you serve ice cream, sometimes you push too hard, and instead of getting Hooke's law for the spoon, you get a yielding which leads to permanent deformation. The spoon is made up of many crystalline grains. If you don't know, that polycrystal, each of those polycrystals has a regular grid of atoms, and in order for the spoon to bend, in practice, these atomic planes within each polycrystal slide over one another, and they do so through the transport of dislocations, which are slips, places where the edge of one plane slipped against another, and those rearrangements of dislocations mediate the plasticity. Interesting things. If you take a crystal and you subject it to gravitational force and you wait long enough, it will flow like a liquid, at least if you're above the roughening transition of the surface of the crystal, which is a technicality, and this is mediated by at least one mechanism, which is vacancy diffusion. If you If you have a thermal equilibrium crystal, there'll be an equilibrium population of vacancies. They'll be created at the top and move down through the force of gravity, or rather the atoms, the vacancy will be created at the bottom and move up through the force of gravity, and that will gradually let the system flow like a puddle. It's not quite the same as a regular crystal in that it maintains its crystalline lattice and its crystalline anisotropy, but there's no rigidity to bulk forces. The rigidity comes only to forces that couple to the Brooklyn symmetry. Yes? I don't think it's an experimental statement. I don't think anybody has tried this. But when people talk about, window pane shearing and how that's in cathedrals, which there's some doubt about, and say that makes it different from crystals, that's not true. Gravity would make a crystalline window pane flow as well. If you couple to the order parameter, of course, it's rigid. And that's because in order for a plane of atoms to shift with respect to another plane, you have to move it, you have to slip atomic planes against one another. It's not good enough to move around vacancies.
Okay. I'm sorry. Yes. This depends on whether there is enough quantum defects for vacancy diffusion.
There's a thermal equilibrium population of vacancies. That's a property of the equilibrium crystal. There are not very many, but we're theorists. Under shear, you have to nucleate a vortex loop, and this is the simplest thing where you remove a part of a plane of atoms, and that's glide, but more important for most plastic purposes is climb. Is glide, dislocations mediate the sliding of one plane against another. Going the wrong direction. This is not going to be primarily the topic of this talk. I just wanted to mention that these are cool processes, and the collective motion of these dislocations produce interesting behavior. The collective motion arises in three-dimensional dislocations because the dislocations form lines, and these lines tangle up. So here are three dislocations, two going vertically and one going horizontally, and under shear, you have to put a certain amount of shear stress on the system before this line, which bows out under shear stress, balloons out and launches a kind of an avalanche. And these avalanches recently have been studied in the engineering community. There were hints ages ago, but now it's a big field. And these avalanches mediate the plastic deformation, but only can be seen in very small pillars or in ice, oddly enough. The memory here, first of all, there's a yield stress below which you get reversible, basically Hooke's law behavior. And then above the yield stress, macroscopically you see plastic deformation, microscopically it decomposes into individual avalanches. And that yield stress depends upon the history in that the yield stress is due to these other dislocations in many cases. And as you shear the material, you generate more and more dislocations, and so the yield stress goes up. It's the collective behavior of these tangles of defects that I'm going to argue is an interesting statistical mechanics problem. So, should these defects behave in any simple way at all, or should they be immensely complicated. Should the properties of a material depend in great detail on exactly how it was beaten and annealed in the past, or should we be able to come up with a simple emergent theory? The examples I give here are things I ran across over the past 30 years. There are these old experiments in spin glasses, which really show you that you can take a complicated non-equilibrium system and store memories in it in very complicated ways. So here, they cool down the system and pause at various temperatures, and then when they heat up, they see bumps in the magnetic susceptibility that are due to microscopic degrees of freedom that are only active in small temperature ranges that then release their magnetization as you heat. Another memory effect, less obvious than this one, is what's called the return point memory that happens in certain kinds of magnets and martensites and other systems. In the return point memory is the first example we'll have of training. So training will come up a couple of other times, and I think many of these things many people in the audience are familiar with. It's the nature of a review. You talk about things you already know. If you take a system and you apply a stress and relieve it and apply a stress and relieve it, you get subloops in the hysteresis loop of the material. And those subloops sometimes will gradually drift. So if you take a piece of metal and do this long enough, its behavior keeps changing as you bend it over and over again until it breaks. But other systems will settle down after a while to a periodic behavior. In the case of these particular magnets, one loop is enough. That if you lower the field and raise the field, it returns back to exactly the same point it left the outer loop. And this is true also of subloops. If you lower the field and raise the field, it returns exactly the same point. And there's an elegant kind of argument that allows you to show this for sort of unfrustrated systems where every spin flipping over wants their neighbors to flip over more, no anti-ferromagnetic bonds. And in principle, you can read out the memory by looking for small kinks in the M of H curve, where each kink represents a previous maximum. Now, a third kind of memory that I've always found entertaining, I learned about from Sue Coppersmith, which they called phase organization. And phase organization has this wonderful global picture. You imagine a complex non-equilibrium system as a collection of local regions which have multiple metastable states. And the model they have is a nail and a ball in a periodic potential with a spring onto the nail. So here's the spring, the nail's in the middle here, and this periodic potential added to the quadratic potential gives you this kind of well structure. And now you imagine some procedure that starts in some arbitrary state, and you relax until it stops moving. A typical non-equilibrium dynamics. And surely, if you start in this well, it will stay in this well. All of these wells are possible states for the system to be in. But by far, the dominant states will be the states that start off in the wings here someplace and fall down until they hit there. So each nail will have a large probability of being right at its extremal states. And then in this model of a complex material as being lots of local regions that act like nails, the hypercube of possible equilibrium states will be dominated by the hypercorners. Now, that's not exactly what Sue developed. Sue was actually looking at a very interesting phenomenon in charge density waves, which involves training. I was mentioning training before. The training was the charge density wave. They would start in some state, and then they would put a voltage pulse of a certain length. And the first time they would put a voltage pulse, the system would evolve and then stop. And then the second voltage pulse, it would evolve with a different path and then stop. But if they kept repeating exactly the same length pulse, they would end up in a particular state that they could measure the current versus time. And so here's the state that it settled into after being trained, after 150 microseconds, 200 microseconds, and so on. These trained CDWs in this nail picture correspond to if you started here and you have the pulse, you would go over the well and fall into the next well. If you start here in one of the metastable states and have a pulse, you don't quite get led to the next well. And so this becomes a dynamics in the set of all metastable states. And in that dynamics, not only do you end up in one of the hypercorners, in the last state, but that hypercorner has a particular phenomenon that at the end of the pulse, you're near the top of the well about to fall into the next. And when the dust settles, that explained the otherwise very mysterious feature of charge density waves, that at the end of this pulse, the current was always on the upswing. So a trained system has a memory of how it got there that can be read out in interesting ways. This will return again in later in the talk. Now, it's amazing how much of our world is comprehensible. It's amazing how many times we can focus our attention on interesting subproblems that we can understand. And one of the most successful is equilibrium thermodynamics. That an equilibrium system, because of a combination of chaotic dynamics, which erases your knowledge of where you started, and a simple rule for how relative weights of different states arise, maximizing entropy, Liouville's theorem allowing you to argue that you can integrate over the energy surface, you not only get reproducible behavior that doesn't depend upon how you got there, but you can actually compute the answer. And in recent times, In recent times, a number of our colleagues, some of them in the audience, have developed serious attempts at taking important non-equilibrium systems, powders and dislocations and glasses, and trying to produce a kind of a non-equilibrium thermodynamics, trying to emulate equilibrium thermodynamics in the the state of a final system will be described by a few macroscopic variables, forgetting the history. We're not special. Engineers always try to do this. Everyone is interested in state variables for their plasticity simulations to try to encompass where they came from and then evolution laws for their state variables. And you would think if Sue Coppersmith and return point memory and all those, the phase organization is applicable to a given system, then there can't be simple state variables because you can store arbitrary memories in the past. So some of these examples are, Edwards has a theory of powders, which originally was described by the compactivity, the change in the entropy as you change the density of a local region. And this theory and all these other theories are discussing the relative probabilities for metastable states. This is weird from the point of view of statistical mechanics that talks about density of points in phase space, probability density. These are probabilities of getting particular configurations, points in configuration space. So in this background here, which I've attempted to make subtle enough that it doesn't distract you from the text, but large enough that you can see, the idea here is that these are the basins of attractions of various metastable states. I stole this from a reference later. And here you have the basins being different sizes. And on the right, you have all the basins being the same size. And Edwards was hypothesizing that the size of all the basins, the size of all the basins of attraction of all metastable states, first was equal, which isn't a crucial assumption. But this crucial assumption is that it was history independent. Whatever you make your powder out of, if it's got the same density, it equally weights, or it has a fixed weighting for all the different possible metastable states. That would be a powerful thing if true. It can't be true if phase organization is true. If phase organization or return point memory or any of those things is relevant for the powders. Later, Bubul Chakraborty and Edwards independently added external force as an important variable. There are effective temperature theories, which instead of thinking about something like compactivity, try to use the energy as the control parameter, and there are such theories for glasses and amorphous metals, for polymers, and for dislocations. So the people who are in the audience, I'm going to mispronounce your name, I'm sorry, Kugliandolo and Jim Langer, but many of these other people were at the last conference I was at. So the question is, can a non-equilibrium system forget its history and partition its state equally or at a fixed distribution among the state of possible configurations? Does that make sense? So what I'm going to argue is that it may be true that some emergent thing like this happens if you're near a critical point. And this was inspired, this wasn't part of the original paper, but it was inspired by an article from Dan Frankel and Bubul Chakraborty and other people whose names I can't, I don't know well, where they looked at a system of, I think, 64 particles, and they prepared it in a certain way, and they prepared it a lot of times, and they counted the number of times they got each of the particle configurations, and then they did so at different pressures, And they found at different densities, and then they measured the pressure and they measured the probability, and they found that some of the states were much more probable than others. So this is log base E, log base 10, this is 10 to the third, this is 10 to the third, and some of these are a billion times more likely than others. And what was interesting is that the enormous range of probabilities that they found got narrower and narrower as they approached the jamming transition. And I'll tell you what the jamming transition is if you don't know in a moment. But this increasing narrowness as you approach the jamming transition suggested that Sam Edwards' conjecture might be correct, not for a typical packing of these particles, but for a packing which is at its minimum pressure, as the pressure goes to zero, as the particles just barely touch one another. Now, why am I not distressed? If I believe that non-equilibrium systems retain their memory, why would a jamming point be special? And the jamming point is special in that it's at a critical point. So here are these particles that are just barely touching and they have just enough right number of neighbors to make everybody rigid and not be able to move. And the jamming point is conjectured to control the behavior.
Can I just ask?
Yes? Oh, that's very interesting. I didn't know that. And I'm an amateur in some ways. I think jamming is supposed to describe hard particles, but I don't understand, because I know if you shake the hard particles, eventually they form a crystal, but they seem to describe hard particles except there, or so, I'm confused. But Bubul and other people in the audience are experts on this, and you can ask them. But surely it's true, and I do know this, that when you prepare points in the protocols that give you these jam states, they have lots of phenomena that are very simple and elegant and are described by the phenomenology of phase transitions, continuous phase transitions. In particular, the free energy of a jam state can be written as a Widom scaling form in terms of ratios of power laws of different control parameters. And when you say something like this, you're really saying something that's in a sense protocol independent. You can have lots of different kinds of systems with different ratios of particle sizes and different preparation histories, and all of them should obey the same kind of scaling law. So this is precisely the kind of thing that has, for some properties, for those properties that are a long wavelength and the large avalanches, the large systems, that you expect a kind of universality. A universality is, in a sense, the same kind of thing as forgetting. Just like equilibrium thermodynamics, where only temperature, pressure, volume matter, here only the relevant variables matter. And lots of irrelevant degrees of freedom do affect the behavior of the material, but don't affect the emergent collective behavior of the material. And that arises from the renormalization group, which again I'll briefly review, although many of you are great experts in this, where you Ken Wilson invented this wonderful idea that you take the space of all possible systems, including where some dimensions describe model parameters and some dimensions describe experimental parameters. The experiments and the theories are all stuck in the same system space. And then you think of a coarse grain flow where you where you blur your eyes and take a system on one scale and make it look like an effective model with fewer microscopic degrees of freedom and different rules for the probabilities of different configurations. So this self-similarity that you see at a critical point is being used to motivate a coarse graining scheme, and if you tune a parameter until you so you now look at this coarse grained system, which is and if you flow to a fixed point, then the fixed point is self-similar. Then anything that flows into the fixed point will be self-similar after a couple of coarse graining steps, and that the behavior near the critical point, even if the critical point is far from the fixed point, will share all the same properties as the behavior near the fixed point on long wavelengths. So, what, is there any hope for crystals? Are crystals near such a critical point? And I don't know, 15 years ago, I would have said that's a silly idea, that I thought of crystals as being an example of something where things were complicated. And then experiments started coming out showing avalanches. So this is the kind of dynamics of an avalanche in a magnetic system in this case, where some domain wall which is stuck on impurities depins in some region and moves forward and then gets stuck again. And these avalanches show lots of emergent simple behavior that's described by critical point. So in particular, if you look at the avalanches individually, they have these nice fractal structures. Their scaling properties, for example, if you take all avalanches of the same duration, they average to something that's now known to be an inverted parabola. There are spatial dependence of avalanches. This is a different kind of avalanche. This is a numerical simulation of a model of coffee invading a napkin. If you dip your napkin into coffee, the dynamics of the motion of the fluid up through the porous network has avalanches of all scales. And now this is an experiment by Karen Dahman here and Julia Greer, where they actually looked at the distribution of sizes of the avalanches, and they found a beautiful agreement with a mean field theory for a critical point. So I'm going, oops, sorry. I'm going to try to, so I'm going to return to this curve. So avalanches have fractal looking objects. They're fractal in time, they're fractal in space, and they have a self-similarity in their sizes. The self-similarity would require that you have a power law here, and these are cutoff power laws. And that's a suggestion that the system is not always at its critical point. You have to go to, you have to tune a parameter to reach the critical point. And I'm going to return to that. These are micropillar avalanches, and so there are lots of reasons they might be cut off. We'll come back to the question of whether this is a feature of real plasticity or if real plasticity just has a power law. The distribution of dislocations in crystals also is complicated. So this is a picture of the dislocations in I think this was the copper sample. And this is a simulation. We spent years trying to mimic the dislocation dynamics by partial differential equations, but that's a different talk. And the question, the next question I'm going to ask, and this is sort of a review of all of the plasticity avalanche kinds of models out there, is whether the critical point that we're talking about is a critical point that describes the entire region of plastic deformation, or whether you need to tune a parameter to reach a critical point. So the early experiments on ice and systems like that emphasize the power law, and there are lots of systems that have power laws that arise naturally without tuning a parameter. And one class of those, self-organized criticality, is depinning transitions. And a good example of that would be what a dislocation line would look like in a two-dimensional system. Of course, two dimensions, dislocations are points. But if you have like a superconducting vortex line moving through a material, then you have a manifold with moving through a higher dimensional space with dirt, and you can analyze that, and there's a critical driving force at which you begin sliding, and critical exponents describing how quickly you'll move if you're over the critical driving force, and systems like that. Now, this doesn't look like a self-organized critical point. It looks like a plain old critical point, except if you drive it at a certain velocity. If you think about this as a driven system where you're imposing not the stress but the velocity, then you naturally self-organize to the critical point. You remember work hardening. Work hardening said that it's harder to move the dislocations after you move them. And work hardening can be thought of as a self-limiting statement that the system depins during an avalanche. The avalanche generates more dislocations and causes the threshold for dislocation motion to rise until it halts. And that's a mechanism for giving you a self-organized kind of behavior. That was one dislocation line. Dislocation lines are, of course, a tangled network, but you can write down effective kinds of theories for tangled networks of dislocations. This is one example that I took from Michael Zeiser's review article. And instead of having a one-dimensional manifold moving in a two-dimensional disordered surface, this is a 12-dimensional order parameter moving around in three dimensions. But the basic, and some would say that this is not a true depinning transition because the interaction energy between different segments of the dislocations is non-local and sometimes anti-ferromagnetic. But without getting into the weeds, it's a similar kind of theory, and it produces similar kinds of avalanches. Now, just as I was saying, there are self-organized and non-self-organized critical points. There are two classes of theories for the self-organized critical points. All of them are mean field in the sense that the locality in space seems to be not very important. This is well known in critical phenomena in high dimensions and long-range forces. And there are a couple of strategies for developing mean field theories. There's a hypertetrahedron, and there's the beta lattice, And the two classes of theories have to do with how you treat this anisotropic strain. So if you have anisotropy in your strain field, you tend to produce more avalanches along one axis and fewer avalanches in the perpendicular direction. And some would say that that leads to kind of shear banding phenomena, in which case you don't care about the other direction and you could ignore the anisotropy. And others embrace the anisotropy. They embrace the antiferromagnetic bonds but ignore the anisotropy, and they give rather different behavior. And the experiments and simulations are giving lots of different behaviors. And so this is still being settled. The other kind of non-self-organized criticality, I'd like to introduce some recent work by Julia Greer's group, Xiaoyue Ni in particular, the graduate student involved, that made a clear analogy between their micropillars. You remember the micropillars looked not self-organized. They didn't have a power law. They had something that cut off and needed to be tuned to a failure stress before they showed a power law. That was Dahman and Greer's picture. This inspired us, this experiment inspired us to try training the micropillar. So these are the experiments in the colloids, in these sheared concentric cylinders embedded in water. They're reversible. If you oscillate the cylinder, unless two particles collide, if a pair of particles collide, then they don't return to the same point afterwards. But the second time you do the same oscillation amplitude, it's likely that the particles that collided the first time stop colliding. So on small amplitudes, you can trainable the few small collisions decay every time you cycle until you get a stable limit cycle. Like plasticity, when you start increasing the amplitude, you get more plastic deformation. You get more of these avalanches. At very large amplitudes, above a critical amplitude, these collisions keep happening. When two particles bump one another, they get knocked on average to more than one new particle each. And that leads to a reversible to irreversible, or I prefer to call it trainability transition. And there are nice diverging training times and amplitudes as you approach it. Similar things have been seen in amorphous solids, granular systems, dislocations, superconducting vortices, and I'm now going to argue that similar things have been seen by Xiaoyue Ni in nanopillars. So here's a squashed nanopillar. Xiaoyue tells me that this picture is horrible, that she wouldn't use this doing data because she likes the pillars to still be straight so that she can interpret properly what's happening. But if you take these nanopillars and you squash them, you don't see the textbook picture where the yield stress is equal to the previous stress maximum. That would be this curve here, the green curve. Instead, she sees precursor avalanches. And one of the interesting questions is whether these precursor avalanches are a finite size effect, or whether a bulk piece of nickel should see them and nobody has bothered to do a careful experiment, or if they do, they don't get excited about it. And as we make our pillars bigger, they get less precursor avalanches, so it could be a finite size effect. These precursor avalanches are trainable. If I start and I see a bunch of precursor avalanches at a certain force that you smash the nanopillar at, and you oscillate many times, they'll die away. This time scale and the amplitude grow as you increase the stress until just below twice the original yield stress. It keeps deforming forever, and so under cycling, the thing is getting squashed farther and farther. And if you plot the curves of the cycle decay time, for example, against the distance to this to a particular critical point, sigma c, you get a nice power law. It's not wonderful, but you notice that the colloidal experiment had reasonably similar behavior. So, we started off with memory and materials. We then went to the possibility of having memory erased due to equilibrium phenomena, because you're near a critical point. I've described to you the current state of the art in dislocation dynamics in a very quick view of a bunch of different theories that try to use critical phenomena to study the behavior of plastically deformed materials. Last thing I want to do is give you a warning that materials are complicated. They're so complicated that a typical person who studies metallurgy will specialize in aluminum alloys. I have a friend who specializes in Matt Miller, who specializes in aluminum alloys. And the idea that they would develop a grand sweeping theory that works for all materials seems a little nuts to them, because they're so different. This is not plastic deformation, this is coarsening, but we all think we understand coarsening. We all think that, oh yeah, the universal power laws, they depend upon the concentrations of the different phases, but after that everything's fine. You look at a rock, and some things that we would predict work, like the grain size grows if you cool it slowly, but a lot of things, like all these facets, are just not part of our theory. And here's the Ising model, and the Ising model has things that look a lot like salad dressing, oil and vinegar separating. But if you change the bonds in the Ising model, add a weak antiferromagnetic bond, you instead get these facet-looking things. That what we think, even from the Ising model, what we think of as universal depends in complicated ways, in this case, on the dynamics of growth, the anisotropic energies of grain boundaries and the dynamics of growth. And it's very likely that the universal scaling theory of coarsening involves universal functions that allow us to incorporate the bewildering variety of crystals. In principle, we could understand them using scaling and universality, but we wouldn't just have a few universal parameters, we would have all universal functions. Thank you very much.
Excuse me, I'm not sure I should be the first person to reply or ask questions, but Jim, as I think you know, I think that a large amount of what you're saying is at best misleading, and some of it is wrong, okay? Now, but let me just try to put this in one particular perspective. When we're talking about real materials, even the ones that you have up there, and we want to know what's interesting, generally what we're doing is we're not looking at them in the way that you did. For example, in the spoon and the ice cream. The thing that you're leaving out is that what we're doing to that spoon is we're deforming it at a finite rate. Okay? And when we do that, we drive these systems into new states of equilibrium where there's a balance between the energy flow through the system and the entropy generated in the system and the energy dissipated. And almost none of your models, certainly not the deep pinning models that you were talking about, account for the fact that that's what the situation in which these materials are most interesting. Now, it's for this conference, of course, we're talking about memories and these with complicated systems, and if we aren't driving the system in a way that is, in effect, stirring them and erasing the memories, then, in fact, we are interested in that kind of stuff. But if, as you were talking about, we're interested in real materials and real behaviors and real engineering applications of those materials, we have to talk about them in other circumstances than the ones that you're talking about. Your depinning model, you didn't make any attempt to show that it, in fact, agrees with the experiments, a vast array of experiments on strain hardening. And I don't think you're going to be able to do that.
By the way, I was describing other people's work. I'm not responsible for all of those models.
But
I believe that they have ambitions to try to.
So I had a question about the last part of what you talked about, which was this work of cyclic loading.
Yes.
And
strong connections with his work. Yes.
No. So they, I think you know the what you showed here in terms of behavior, this is sort of similar to both what you see in the original sort of colloidal suspension work, as well as in glasses, where in a model glasses, which we have been looking at. But as we discussed earlier, in terms of the avalanches leading up to this transition, for the glasses there seems to be a difference. But it just occurred to me that even for the colloidal system, in fact, despite the similarities, in the trained systems you don't have any activity, and therefore the avalanche statistics is fundamentally different. So do you have something?
I'm sorry, the train system you don't have?
You don't have any more displacements of particles once you reach a steady state. And so there, in fact, there is no activity, right?
I'm not sure what you're saying, but
this is okay.
In the train state, we can't tell whether this residual activity is noise, but we think it's noise. We think in fact that the train system, to a good approximation,
right,
has stopped having any rearrangements,
right,
which is different from training in other systems where you have a residual hysteresis loop. And are you saying that?
No. So I'm saying that what you're showing, the specific data you're showing, actually does behave consistently in all the different systems that we are talking about. But in terms of avalanching behavior leading up to this threshold state, there I think there are differences which are interesting to discuss. We discussed it in the context of glasses yesterday offline. But even for the colloidal suspensions, for the original experiment that you made reference to, it's actually very different.
The colloidal Okay.
There are other questions?
So sorry, just because this
slide is up, I can't help but say, you said that that was a reasonable power law fit.
I'm not.
I quoted what, I remembered what you said, and I just want to say for the record, that's not a power law fit.
What I was really trying to say is, given the stretch that we've made to extract these timescales at all, the fact that our data points are not that much worse than the original data point. I guess that's going too far. These two points are noticeably worse than these four points, but this is as good as we have.
Yeah.
No, I'm good. Yes. We're not pretending other than I think this is quite interesting and sort of convincing, and I would not suggest that we could extract a power law from those points. Yeah.
Jim, I want to ask you a naive question.
Yeah.
That lovely potential you showed us from Sue Coppersmith's work with the...
Yeah.
Okay. That potential looks a lot to me like the interaction of a pair of straight dislocations of opposite Berger's vector with the Pyrrhus barrier, because they have an attractive interaction which makes a well, but when you have the Pyrrhus barrier, it gets very bumpy, just like that. Is there any significance to that coincidence?
You'd have to ask Sue, but I don't think so. And I don't think, in most of these materials, the Pyrrhus barrier is extremely small. So,
but if we do atomistic simulations of dislocation pair annihilation, if they're far enough apart and their attractive interaction will not overcome the Pyrrhus barrier, they won't annihilate.
If you use interatomic potentials suitable for metals, then the Pyrrhus barrier will be extremely small. It just turns out that especially if they're not parallel, if they're at angles to the crystalline axes, they have kinks on them, and the kinks can slide really easily, and it sort of eliminates all the Pyrrhus barriers. But in any case, the metastable states are thought in FCC metals to be predominantly due to dislocation tangles and not the crystalline lattice. But
some of the kinds of complications that come up are, for instance, that screw dislocations divide into partials, and then
yep.
to cross-slip, they have to join together. And there's all those complications that are different in FCC, BCC,
yeah.
different types of materials.
And the split partials really do have to do with exactly the periodicity of the lattice. So that there could be a link there in some way. But I think really it's a metaphor. It's a simple model that's supposed to be applicable to everything, and so it wasn't designed to have anything to do with dislocations.
Okay, thank you.
It was designed for charge density waves.
Okay, thank you. I think it's time to...
Thank you.
So the next talk is by Rémi Monasson.